If you thought the sequester was bad, wait till you see the CR. Today on Backroom Politics, we're talking, now that the sequester's here, what's next? And the fight for the CR is about to get even dirtier. Also, cybersecurity in the Chinese government. Who exactly is hacking into the New York Times? Why would you want to? And how powerful is CPAC in D.C.? This and tell me a story today on Backroom Politics.
Live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., this is Backroom Politics with your moderator, Justin Russell. To join the political discussion today, you can call toll-free at 877-662-3713. And now, with the roundtable, your moderator, Justin Russell.
Hey, it's Tuesday out there in Radio Land, and that means it's time for the best political roundtable you've never heard of. This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Joining me, as they do every Tuesday, to my left, he is the former 8th-term member of Congress representing Washington's 2nd Congressional District. He is the Honorable Congressman Al Swift. Hello, Congressman.
Hello. How are you? Are you waiting for the snow?
I am waiting for the snow. It's Snowmageddon, or, as I was heard, the name for it this year, Snowquestration. To my 11 o'clock, as he is every Tuesday, he is the former floor chief for Congressman Gerald R. Ford. He is the longtime vice president of government affairs for the National Broadcasting Corporation. He is the Honorable Bob Hines. Hi, Bob.
Hello, Justin.
Are you ready for Snowquestration?
Well, I've got my shovel to shovel whatever we've got here.
Oh, then this is a snowblower compared to some of this stuff. And to my 12 o'clock, he is the former Undersecretary of Commerce, longtime Senate staffer, longtime Washington insider, and distinguished fellow at Simpson Center. He is the Honorable Alan Moore. Hi, Alan.
Gentlemen, this was a big week at the Stimson Center because it was one of 11 winners of a MacArthur Foundation Prize. This is the small NGO prize comparable to their MacArthur Genius Awards. Stimson won $1 million prize, the only D.C.-based small NGO to win one.
Big congratulations. Congratulations to our friends at the Stimson Center. That is amazing. Our Democratic friend, Carl Tuvin, is out with a stomach bug this week. He'll join us next week, but there's a lot going on. Obviously, last Friday morning, everybody woke up and celebrated Happy Sequestration, and people started waiting for pink slips. People started waiting for their layoffs. People started waiting for the ceiling to come down on government. It didn't necessarily happen, but it did send a shockwave through D.C. and through the country. We are hearing about slowdowns at TSA lines. We are hearing about slowdowns in air traffic control. We are hearing about teachers, if you listen to Arne Duncan, Secretary of Education, we're hearing about widespread layoffs in education. Teachers are going to be walking the streets aimlessly. Alan, I want to start with you. What's the reality? We saw sequestration come in. We saw it just come in like a lion. Did it settle like a lamb?
It came in with a whimper, not the bang that the president had been trying to make people fear. We talked about it last week, this sort of sky is falling, horror of horrors, apocalyptic, catastrophic kind of conversation, which, as we said last week, was apocalyptic garbage. The sequester is not a big deal. It's a medium-sized deal. It's a small to medium size, and it's a slow-moving proposition. And rather than focus on trying to bring everybody together and come up with a bigger solution, we lost time by the president and then some of his cabinet members going out with scare tactics.
Well, I mean, we Congressman Al, I mean, we saw the Secretary of Education actually back down today from his quote-unquote rhetoric, if you will, saying that education, kids were going to be running around like anarchists throughout the country. He backed down and said, let me clarify. The rhetoric definitely has gotten thick, about as thick as the snow's going to be here in D.C.
Well, I don't think it's going to snow, so.
That's right. Well, you see, I agree with a lot of what Alan said and fundamentally disagree with his point. It is certainly true that sequestration was going to take its time to be built, and therefore the president's would have been probably better off to have not made it such a crisis. But what he was trying to do was to get Congress stirred up enough so that they would head it off altogether. And you can't do that if you say, you know, by August you're going to have some real problems on your hands. So he did what he did. If nothing else happens, and it will, and we'll get to that later
in
this next segment, but if nothing else happens, I think sequestration will be very, very, very hurtful down the line, but it wasn't going to be felt today.
Well, Bob Hines, when you listen to the folks in the defense sector, they're saying they're already feeling the pinch right now. According to several sources at DOD, a lot of the Air National Guard ready flight teams are grounded. We still have issues of major equipment repairs, major dry docking not happening as a result of sequestration. Sequestration, did it really focus on DOD larger than it did any other sector in government?
Well, it's fair to say that as a percentage of the cuts, more than 50% by maybe 53 or 54% is on the defense side, and about 46%, 7% is on the domestic side. And probably as a department, the Defense Department is going to suffer more than any other, because defense is the Defense Department. So the other agencies that are on the domestic side that are being hit are have a much smaller hit. So it's a much wider shot they had to take on. They have to use a shotgun on the domestic side, so to speak. They used a rifle shot on the one thing on the defense side. That's the Defense Department.
But
obviously, it's going to cut that a little bit more deeply. But I don't think that we're going to see a situation. As a matter of fact, I'd be very surprised if we saw a situation where something seriously was being short. Change which we absolutely needed to have available to us. I wouldn't think that's going to be allowed to be happening.
Congressman Al, you have a puzzled look on your face. You don't necessarily agree with what Bob's calling out.
No, it's not disagreement. It just should be mentioned, and I don't happen to know what it is, but it's the Feds is the largest budget. I don't know what percentage of the total budget it is, but it's got to give more in absolute dollars than any other agency.
As far as total discretionary spending, defense is a large chunk of discretionary spending, no question about it. But Alan Moore, you know, defense, I mean, we're talking national security issues. I mean, even if you ground Air National Guard ready flights, that puts air defense at risk. It puts the National Capital Region in a little bit of a quandary right now. Is it fair to say that this was a wake-up call to say, look, we got to cut somewhere. We might as well cut the biggest discretionary point in the budget.
Remember, when this thing was created in 2011, mid-year, the idea was we're going to do a meat cleaver type approach, which is so stupid in its construction that surely calmer heads will come together and figure out a better way. They tried. They failed. There was no conscious decision way back when, boy, we're going to stick it to defense, we're going to stick it to domestic spending, we're going to leave taxes out of the mix. The thought, and this is part of a big argument going on between Bob Woodward and the White House, which we may or may not get into, but there was never anybody's plan to make this work. It was just that it turned out that there wasn't enough votes to do something else. Now we're into it, and now we're going to watch this slow-moving problem and we can start doing fixes if we want to.
Congressman Al.
I'm just wondering if in fact everybody believed that this was so dumb and so stupid, no one would ever let it happen, then what are the people who did let it happen? Are they that stupid and that dumb? Or,
well, this brings up a valid point. Bob Hines, you have a thought on that.
Well, I don't think, you know, remind ourselves that the Congress, particularly in the House, is hugely divided. I mean, the divisions have never been so sharp in my time in Washington, which goes back, unfortunately, something like almost 45, 50 years.
You're dating yourself.
Yes, I am.
Okay, just letting you know.
He's much older than I am.
I know. Shocking.
Hey, listen, I take offense at that.
Hey, I would too, Bob.
But the fact of the matter is they are so divisive. And on the Republican side, at least, while this was developing, the strategy, the reality was the Tea Party people had never been in this kind of a situation before. And I don't think they really understood how deeply this problem is, and how serious it is, and how dangerous something like that is. Now, we may learn something from this sequestration. What we may learn is it ain't as bad as we thought it is.
Well,
it doesn't get that bad, because every time, as we see something going forward over the next few months, if we see there's a problem in a particular area, mark my words, people on Capitol Hill are going to rush to make sure it doesn't get too serious.
Well, Bob, I mean, when you say it hasn't been much of an impact, tell that to the 250,000 DOD contract and civilian employees that are basically going to be cut 20% of their salary.
I didn't say anything about it wasn't a serious situation. I said the people who did it on Capitol Hill were fundamentally, number one, very divided, and on at least in one party, hugely a new group of people who had no concept of what they were getting into.
Do we blame sequestration, Alan Moore, on the fact that we've had such huge freshman classes, particularly coming into the House, and don't have the experience of dealing how government really works?
Well, that's a factor, but what we blame it on is what happened in this economy in 2007 and 2008, and our inability ever since then to figure out how to get the economy rolling again in the current situation, and then over the long term to make some progress in lowering the amount of deficit spending that we have. And there are big disagreements on the urgency of those two things against each other and how much we can do. When Al said, if this was such a bad idea, how did it happen? Well, when push came to shove in the last month, people standing back looking at it saying, what's worse? Caving on something we feel really, really strongly about, or letting this thing play out a little bit. And obviously people decided, let's let it play out. But you can't know what the total impact is. This, when you say 250,000 people are going to have their salaries cut 20%, we don't know that that's going to occur. Already in the continuing resolution conversations, there's talk about putting about $7 or $8 billion back into defense. This is still a moving target that's underway out there.
Well, we're going to talk about the CR, because the CR's got some interesting developments happening in the past 48 hours. But going back to sequestration, Congressman Al, it surprises me that over the past 72 hours since they invoked and the president signed the bill late Friday, that we've heard some Democrats even say, you know what, maybe this isn't such a bad idea. It is easier for us to build up from a low bar than it is for us to have a high bar in spending and try and take away. Is there logic in that?
Well, I think the logic is that it positions them to explain this to their constituents a little bit better than it might otherwise be the case. And the Democrats, fear that they can be blamed for this too. Probably the Republicans will get more blame if blame comes about than the Democrats, but the Democrats aren't going to get off scot-free either.
Alan Moore.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is that because of the exaggerated language from the administration, and then the fact that the day came and disaster didn't befall immediately, there's a credibility issue. It's this sky is falling thing that we talked about before, and it makes it all the harder now. What we needed to do, and we've said this before, is back in December when we
kicked the can down the road.
Well, no, when we passed a tax bill that increased the top rate. And the Democrats chest thumped. We showed you guys we won the election. We got the tax rate raised. It gave the Republicans a chance to lick their wounds and say, we've already done taxes. And on the immediate aftermath of that, White House is saying, give us more revenue.
Wait a minute. Does that support Speaker Boehner's position of, look, we did our job? It's now somebody else has got to pick up this bag.
It's not we did our job. He said, we've done taxes. You were talking about taxes, making the millionaires and billionaires pay more. We raised the rate. All we did on January 1 was taxes. We've done taxes. Quit talking about taxes. Quit talking about even more revenues. We heard that. We did that. Let's focus on spending now. That's the problem. Rather than do everything together comprehensively.
But Congressman Al, I mean, raising the taxes on the higher brackets does not take away the fact that we still have, according to many Democrats in both the House and the Senate, that we still have a dysfunctional tax law. The tax law has got to be reformed. You would think that the Democrats would be pushing for that harder than anybody, but they haven't gotten that gold ring yet.
And I don't understand it. What I do understand is that you can't write a true tax reform overnight. And the idea that you're going to do tax reform as the way of achieving the goal within the time frame that they had is insane. And if they tried it, they'd come up with a real horrendous mess.
Would they, Alan Moore?
No one was suggesting that here's the new tax bill. What the whole idea has been and would be is you need to reform taxes. The question is, and you have a year to do it, and those orders go out. The question is, does it have to raise revenue to help solve the deficit, or can it be revenue neutral? No one is arguing that the current tax system works well. The argument is over, if you reform it, do you have to raise revenue to do it, or can you do it in a revenue neutral way? That's the fight.
Bob Hines.
Not only is that the fight, there's a bill right now in draft form that Chairman Dave Camp of the Ways and Means Committee in the House, where the tax law has to initiate from, has put together a wide opportunity sitting there in his committee. And he's holding it and waiting for something to happen. Now, that's basically a Republican bill. And it's going to be a bill that doesn't so much raise a lot of money, although it will raise some, but it's basically an effort to clean things up. Now, at some point, that's going to be the Speaker is going to want that on the table. He doesn't want it on the table now.
Does it make sense for him to put it on the table now?
No. It doesn't.
Why?
Because the Democrats at this stage are about as willing to touch the entitlements as I am to cut my head off. They're not going to do it. Until the Democrats are in a position to say we're going to deal with cleaning up and making the entitlements long-term stability an important feature of our laws. We don't have that. And until that's done, I think that the Republicans are smart to hold back.
But Congressman, now it seems to me that Democrats are in the right position to say this. They've got the majority in the Senate. They've got the White House in the bully pulpit. What's the holdback?
What's the holdback?
What's the holdback for them saying, look, let's bring proper tax reform to the table right now, even if it is a Republican bill, it'll show bipartisanship.
I think, and each of you grab your heart, don't have an attack, but I think that we know that there's an extreme side to the Republicans and the Tea Party and what have you. What has been rather miraculous is how quiet the more extreme people on the left have been throughout all of this. And what the Democratic leaders know is once you move on to these other ones, their extremists are going to explode, and they're going to have as many problems as Boehner has with some of his.
So I think it's the fear of the far left screwing things up for the Democrats that keeps the leadership from doing it. Personally, I believe that the Democrats should be leading the way on it. If you're afraid that it's going to be done wrong, the answer to that is you do it right. And by not doing anything, by sitting there saying you can't touch it, it's unrealistic, and you basically are going to leave it up to the Republicans to propose how to do it, and that's dumb. In terms of policy, Dave Camp has been working on this, and I have no idea what's in his bill, but because he's been working on it quietly for such a long time, I think it probably is a more thoughtful bill than what I was talking about just a moment ago. But it will not be satisfactory to the Democrats,
no.
I'm sure. But so what is the Democrats' answer? And they should be out there with something so that we can have a debate over how you do it rather than whether you do it, because I think it's got to go.
Ball lines.
The most important thing to remember is with respect to the entitlements is this. The Democrats' battle cry last year, you know, is we're going to save our entitlements, you know, as they are. Well, they can't. And they know it at least as well as anybody else in the world does, because the reality is that we are running out of money. Social Security money we're going to be shorting out, not bringing in as much revenue as we are taking out within the next five or six years. We're already in a terrible problem with our health care, and we have got to find a way to manage those programs in a way that provides the stability to the program and the benefits that are needed. And it can be done. Europe's been able to do it. Canada's been able to do it. Why the hell can't the United States?
Well, that does raise a good question. I mean, when you look at a conservative leader in government, i.e. The Prime Minister of the UK and his coalition government, they've actually come up with a coalition government solution in saying, look, we have no choice. Austerity is the way to go. Alan Moore, we've seen it with Stephen Harper in Canada, and he's effectively put in austerity measures on all sides. Everybody's taking a hit. That's not a message that can effectively be brought down to the U.S. What makes the U.S. different?
Well, I think that is a message that is floating around the U.S. right now, and I think that even Republicans would acknowledge that some difficult decisions have already been made that hurt. It's just that they argue that we need to do more, and we need to do more sooner, not just later. The timing of this stuff is a big part of the challenge.
Congressman Al.
I think the difference is that politics in the United States is sick. There are a lot of reasons for it, but we are not currently in a position to be able to sit down and rationally discuss things and begin the compromises and so forth and so on. It's just sick. And until we get well, I don't know that much is going to happen.
Bob Hines.
You know, Al, I would agree with you that, you know, broadly, you're absolutely right. But it's also true, and we've all seen indications of it over the last year or two, that there are groups in the Congress, in both parties, both houses, that have met and talked and worked and tried to figure out how to take care of some of these things. The trouble is, they're a minority in their own party, they're a minority, and they are not in a position to go public, obviously. Leadership won't let that happen. And it's a situation where we've had gangs of this and groups of that in both the House and the Senate who have tried to find solutions that are broad enough for both parties to agree to. But when you get right down to it, the extremists on the left and on the right, and the Democrats and the Republicans, have not been willing to move off their stated positions.
Alan Moore, you chuckled a little bit during that last interaction.
Well, yeah, excuse me, but I the reason I chuckled is I happened to see a crawl up on CNN that, instill another one of the horrors of sequestration. The White House has cut back on White House tours in response to sequestration. So
this hurts everybody.
Boy, this sequestration is
the horror.
This is the kind of tokenism and nonsense that hurts the credibility of those who say, this really is serious, people.
Well,
it is serious.
This leads me to my next question, though. I mean, when we look at the finger-pointing that's been going on since Friday night, you know, as early as Friday morning, the president was saying, look, this is not my fault. I have no skin in this game. You want to blame somebody, blame the Republicans in the House. You've got members in the House leading with Eric Cantor, with Kevin McCarthy, saying, look, the onus of this, this is the president. This is the president's fault. If you got anybody to blame, blame the president. I go to you, Bob Hines. Where's the reality?
The reality is to spread the blame all over the place, quite frankly.
But are we not just scraping one pile of crap into another pile of crap and trying to fertilize
this
whole thing?
We are.
Yes.
And it gets worse every year. We get deeper into the hole. We are just continuing to refuse to do what we have to do.
We have a
credit card bill of $16 trillion.
But we see a little light of leadership. You know, when I was watching towards the end, as we were getting closer and closer to sequestration, we see a little light of leadership in the eyes of, like, Senator Kelly Ayotte, of the Republican out of New Hampshire. She actually spent 2 weeks at least putting together an alternative spending bill that would have alleviated sequestration altogether, and could not get a good hearing up and down vote on her bill in the Senate. Do the Democrats take blame for that?
I would believe they would have to, since they control the committee structure and the right to set the agendas.
Congressman Al, you would think that in the interest of quote-unquote everybody swearing up and down, we're going to be bipartisan, they would have at least heard it out and at least given an up and down vote.
Well, The fact that they are running the Senate, except for the filibuster, which they have to worry about, the fact that they didn't even come up for a vote is clearly the fault of the Democratic leadership.
Alan Moore.
And I had something to add, but it's a little bit different topic. So
okay,
Alan Moore.
Yeah, with regard to, I mean, Kelly Ayotte had a proposal, and she had a handful of people who supported it.
There were Democrats that supported it.
There were a handful of people who were supportive, but she didn't begin to have the votes. The way the whole issue was set up, there would be a Democrat alternative and a Republican alternative, and there was a different Republican alternative that enjoyed a lot more support among the Republicans and a few Democrats. It did not. Either one of these proposals had to get 60 votes. Neither one could have. Kelly Ayotte's proposal would have gotten fewer than either of those. So this is one that was not a, gee, let's throw out 20 different options. The whole thing was set up so that the Democrats would have one, the Republicans would have one. They both had a vote. Neither one passed, as everyone knew, and then sequestration hit. So
isn't it the type of leadership that Kelly Ayotte showed, and respectively Paul Ryan showed when he came up with his budget alternative? Isn't that the type of leadership that American voters really want to see coming out of Washington?
Well, what they want to see is something that can get the votes. It's not a handful of people on both sides. It's a majority. It's enough to have action, make action occur. But there was a lot of hard feelings about how the sequestration thing was played out. There was the missed opportunity that I already talked about back at the end of the year. So none of this is a huge surprise right now. It's annoying. It's painful. But we're going to muddle this thing through for a while.
Congressman Al, you had a thought.
Well, I'm just thinking that what we just said does make the Democratic leadership look a little less villainous, because if you don't have the votes, there's no point in bringing it to the floor. But it also seems to me, Abba Ibn said about Yasser Arafat once, said he never missed an opportunity to miss an opportunity. And it looks to me like the leadership of both parties in both houses have never missed an opportunity to miss an opportunity. And both sides can be blamed for that, I believe. The thing that I wanted, that I don't understand about the Democrats is that they treat any suggestion that we approach entitlements as though we're going to abolish them, or that we're going to do something terribly draconian. there are a number of things one can do that would be long term, and I don't know how much it helps our current problem, but long term, in adjusting ages and when you, how much you pay and when you pay, and how whether you increase the level in which you continue to pay so that the rich continue to pay into it for a longer period of time, and as you get, and you have to get older before you click in and put that in the out years so that people will have an opportunity to plan for it. These are all should be on the table and be discussed. And it seems to me that the Democrats are in a position to do that, and that they should certainly be more comfortable doing that than letting the Republicans do it.
Well, Bob, hold that thought, because when we come back, we're going to lead into the CR discussion, which your thought, I think, might lead in as a good segue.
One line.
Go ahead.
The fact of the matter is, with the President and the Senate, they may never have a better chance, the Democrats, to do it in a way that is long-term and doesn't hurt anybody. I would think they would see that as an opportunity. I don't know.
He stated it better than I did.
Well, hold that thought. When we come back, we're going to talk about... Even though it was wrong. When we come back, we're going to continue this discussion and talk about the upcoming CR fight, which is going to make this look like a pillow fight. This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Backroom in Washington, D.C. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay
Alan's
with us.
Wrong.
You know, for those who listen to Backroom Politics and know about Shelley's Backroom, they think of it as some sort of cigar bar where politicians go to smoke their cigars and drink their martinis. Actually, what you don't know about Shelley's Back Room has one of the greatest menus in the city. I kid you not. You've got the campfire wings, famous campfire wings. 1 pound of roasted, not fried, seasoned marinated jumbo chicken rings served with their own special honey mustard sauce. Folks, if you like chicken wings, you've never had the campfire wings. Best wings in the city, bar none, I guarantee. If you don't like it, Al, you can call us up and tell us that you don't like it. You have daily specials. Come down on a day when they have the Justin Chicken Sandwich, the sandwich named after me, breaded chicken breast, provolone cheese, thick-cut bacon on a Kaiser roll served with a honey mustard sauce. Folks, it doesn't get more artery-clogging than that, but it is worth it. Come down to Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., the premier sponsor of Backroom Politics.
Backroom, 1331 F Street, the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics. We're continuing the discussion from last segment where we were talking about the sequestration now that it's in place, but now we got a bigger fight on our hands. that of the continuing resolution. As those of you may or may not know, the federal government has not had a budget since 2009, and it has been a painful experience to try and get stuff done in federal government. So instead, they put in temporary spending measures called the continuing resolution. At the end of March, the federal government will lose all spending power and authority, thereby shutting down the government, unless we come up with a budget or we come up with another continuing resolution, which doesn't help the problem. Bob Hines, the CR has been a pain in Obama's rear end since he took office. Yet it seems that the White House has not been able to get any sort of budget deal in place, let alone providing a presidential budget request to the Hill. What could possibly be a holdup for them not to take the reins of the bully pulpit and push a budget through?
Probably because there are enough divisions in the Democratic Party in the Senate they can't get it through. He has set budgets up every year, and every year the Senate doesn't even take them up. There are things that you have to do, and that we've talked a bit about some of the financial problems as we ended the last half hour. But the fact of the matter is, if you don't want to deal with the problems, the best thing to do is as we've been doing for years, kicking the can down the road.
But Alan Moore, when we look at kicking the can down the road, we've been kicking this can for literally 4 years, for four budget cycles, and yet no resolution. What is going to make the end of March any different? Are we going to see a budget, which, by the way, according to Mitch McConnell and the Republicans in the Senate, it's a month late. They needed that thing back in February.
Well, let's define our terms here, because we're mixing up some apples and some oranges.
Okay.
There is something called a budget resolution, which is a concurrent resolution between the Senate and the House that is supposed to occur and has not for 4 years. And what a budget resolution does is it sets a floor on revenues. It said we have to come up this year with laws that get at least this much money coming in, and it puts a ceiling on spending. That's all it does. It makes assumptions on how you get there, and those can be very controversial. That's what a budget resolution does. We haven't had one in 4 years. The Senate has been the problem because the Senate has not wanted to bring a bill to the floor that, under the rules, is wide open to amendments. So it's been afraid of all those amendments. We have not had a budget resolution. We have certainly functioned as a government. We've sometimes passed annual appropriations bills. Sometimes we have not been able to finish all the annual appropriations bills, and we extended a bill partway. Right now, most of government, but not all, most of government is operating on what's called a CR, a continuing resolution, which meant that we're spending at about the same level
as we did in 2009.
Not 2009, 2012.
Correct.
Last year. So it expires here in a few weeks, March 27th, and we have to make a judgment. Do we just push it to the end of the year, or do we make more changes to the bill? Those are appropriations bills. They're not budget resolutions. Those are the spending bills that are required for government to function. The White House and the Republicans have said, we don't want to shut down government. We want a resolution here on a continuing resolution. The appropriations committees of both houses are working on that. Meanwhile, the budget committees in the House and the Senate are working on a budget resolution for 2014. The next year. It's, as I say, apples and oranges, two different things.
Correct, but they do interlink together, because what we have right now is we are literally coming into now middle of second quarter fiscal year 2013. By now, the president should have sent his budget request up from all of his component agencies up to the Hill for their requirements. That has not happened as of yet. That means that we are still kind of working in the blind, which means that you have appropriators that can't appropriate based on the request. You have a budget committee that can't really budget for something that we don't know what the government needs to spend on.
The president's budget will be a budget for the year 2014 that begins October 1 of this year.
Correct.
That has nothing to do, except peripherally, with making the decision on how much to spend over the last 6 months of this year. We don't need the president's budget to figure out how much to spend this year. We just need a consensus of enough votes to pass the spending bills to carry us out through the end of this year.
You agree with that? Is the presidential budget request for 14 irrelevant for what we've got to do here in closing out fiscal year 13?
It has been in the past, so I'm not sure why. It does occur to me that all of this is coming down on March 27th. I'm leaving the country on March 26th, and I advise some of you consider joining.
Al's got a great place.
So, but anyway, Al, you know, when we look at the current fiscal situation, the current fiscal crisis in the federal government, in the way it's going to spend, when we talk about a presidential budget request, the president's going to swing for the fences. Yet, what we don't know is exactly where the revenue baseline is going to be that we're going to be able to even come up with a possible budget for 14. At some point, they've got to bridge that gap, going off of what Alan's saying.
Politics is sick. I keep coming back to that. The reason that the stark reality of what you say exists is because we simply aren't talking to each other. I mean, I hate... We've been saying this for weeks and months, and so it's redundant. But until Congress is willing to talk to each other and willing to understand that you've got to take into consideration the other guy's point of view, until that happens, I think we're stuck. I'm very pessimistic.
But, you know, when we hear the Democrats talking about the economy is growing, not as quickly as we see, the Republicans on the flip side, Bob Hines, are talking about our economy is still fragile. News just came out just a few minutes ago. The Dow closed at a new all-time high at 14,200. So what is exactly the gap that we've got to address in order for us to say the economy's solid, this is what we need to spend in order for government to operate in the coming fiscal year, and at the same time, what are we going to do to close out fiscal year 13?
Well, Alan said it right. We've got budget resolution. You've got a CR we're playing with. The problem is not anything except a refusal on both sides to compromise. It's as simple as that. We're not going to solve the problem.
They won't even talk.
Yeah, we will not solve this problem until people are willing to come together and say, I'll give this if you'll give that. And neither party is willing to do
it.
In both caucuses, in the House and in the Senate, you've got people who would like to make arrangements with other guys on the gals on the other side, but they can't do it. They're in a minority, and the leadership won't let them. I mean, the problems are very, very difficult, and they're structural at this point. You've got people who literally don't know how to say the word yes.
But Alan Moore, what we're seeing also is, going off what Bob was saying, we're seeing members of the House not even talking to each other ex parte in the halls and their offices, trying to cut deals. It seems like members of Congress are speaking to each other during 1 minute floor speeches. That seems to be the conversational avenue of communication these days. Is that a disturbing trend?
Well, on the one hand, it's a disturbing trend. There is some of that. On the other hand, there's a lot more conversation back and forth than we would ever begin to realize. Al himself has talked about what it was like when he was there, and there were people he didn't know on the other side of the aisle and didn't particularly like, and then he got a chance to take a trip with them and got to meet them and became their friends. That stuff still goes on. It doesn't go on. There's no evidence that it goes on as much as it used to, but it still goes on. The guy who's across the hall, who's down the hall, whose wives meet each other, it's not as connected as it once was, but it is not totally disconnected. But it's not about guys talking across about the average member talking. It's leaders. It's the president saying, "We're in a tough bind here. Let's bring people to. Let's bring the top group together and see what we can hammer out, rather than go around the country and hammer them over the head and blame them and try to score political points, rather than say, we're all in this together. I'm going to quit beating you guys up if you quit beating me up, and let's see if we can work something out." The problem in government A right now is there really are a lot wide differences of opinion on the centers of the two parties on what should be done, and it's hard to bridge that gap. And there's no true emergency. If we were going to shut down government, we've tried that. That I don't think is going to happen. That's what the CR is all about. If the same thing could occur if we breach the debt limit in May, and we suddenly are in a shutdown mode, I don't see that happening. But the thing about sequestration was, it's just slow moving, slow motion. When we face a crisis or the need to respond, like we did after Hurricane Sandy, we put $60 billion on the table.
But that was like pulling teeth.
Well, it should be like pulling teeth.
Why?
Because it's $60 billion that's not offset. That is not the kind of thing you just say, here's what the governors want. Fine, let's do it.
But yet we see.
It got done, is my point.
But yet we see, and I'm in favor of this, but when we talk about this, we see a CR proposal, a continuing resolution proposal, that increases spending on State Department security by $2 billion. So at what point do we say, wait a minute, we've got to take a look at, if we're going to cut like the $60 billion, or we're going to fight on the $60 billion that went to the Sandy relief, which arguably was needed, this $2 billion for Department of Security, Department of State Security is obviously needed, but there's no offset to that either. They're talking about putting out a CR that has more spending in it.
Well, we probably need a CR that has some more spending in it.
Why are we surprised?
As opposed to continuing what we were spending before from last year. Needs change. That's one of the things. One of the things going on in the CR talks in the House and separately in the Senate is, how can we mitigate some of the problems we see with sequester? Where can we move some money around? How do we get $7 billion more to the Defense Department? Where can we create some flexibility, something we talked about last week? Those are the kinds of things that are part of the CR discussion, and that's where sequester and CR come together and lead up, of course, to the debt limit.
But then, Congressman Al, that leads to the discussion of, hey, sequester wasn't a bad idea. It's easier to build up from zero than it is to take down from 100.
Well, sequester was a dreadful idea because it's not governing. It's setting up phony goals and what have you.
It's throwing crap against the wall, seeing what sticks.
That's right. Instead of sitting down and trying to work out a problem. For example, all of those people who say that absolutely we must cut spending, and yes, of course, we should give the $60 billion to the governors. Yes, of course, we do need to help the security of the State Department. But we've got to cut spending. Well, where? And the idea that, the sequestration was the ass that they were taking to it, but they're not sitting down trying to find money that does not cripple the appropriate functions of government. You have to sit down with each other and talk about that, and we're not doing it, and therefore I don't see how we're going to avoid how we're going to get a CR.
You don't think we're going to have a continuing resolution by March?
I think you almost have to, but how are they going to do it without increase in spending or increased revenue?
Bob, you served on staff in the House of Representatives for a long time. How do they do it in the House?
mirrors.
That's not exactly something that the American electorate want to hear, Bob. You're not really helping out the comfort level here, Bob.
No, look, the reality is that there will be a resolution. They will get one. Now, I don't know how they're going to do it or what is going to be compromised or where they're going to work it out, but we are not going to close the government down on the 27th of March.
Alan Moore?
Yeah, just a comment. Remember, this is a spending bill, the continuing resolution, the continuing appropriations bill. We don't need revenue in that bill. Revenue is not part of that. It's how much are we going to spend in the last half of the year? And are we going to stay at the same level that we spent for the first 6 months, or are we going to make some adjustments? And it looks now like they're talking about additional adjustments. The House says we're going to put we're going to move some money towards defense and give a little flexibility. And the Senate is saying, well, if you're going to do that on the defense side, we want to do that on the domestic side. This is a relatively contained debate on the CR. The bigger, harder stuff is the sequestration, which we're only in the first year of, remember, and we got nine more, and the debt limit. And are we going to have a budget resolution this year? Because part of the debt limit deal was if you don't have a budget resolution by April 15th, then congressional pay stops.
Correct.
So there's some stuff out there that has everybody's attention, and they kind of interact, and it's hard to keep them separate in our head, but they're not all the same, and they don't involve all the same people, even if in a big way they all involve some of the same political tensions.
Bob Hines, you had a comment in between your standing ovation there.
Yeah,
I just want to emphasize something that Alan said. The CR just says this is what we're going to spend. So that's not that hard to do. It doesn't say how we're going to get the money to pay for it. That's the hard stuff. And that is not that's why there will be a CR.
Congressman Al.
In the middle of probably the biggest debate about cutting spending in our lifetime, we have been spending more money. I mean, it's hard for me to believe that we're having this whole sequestration argument and all the other arguments over here, and by God, we're not going to raise taxes, and we've got to cut spending and all of that. And then we have $60 billion for this, and they add another $2 billion for that, and what have you over here. It's schizophrenic.
It is. I mean, Alan Moore, you have to admit, the hypocrisy here is just running rampant through Congress, when you've got Republicans that are sitting there saying, hey, wait a minute, we got to cut spending, but yet we're going to support a continuing resolution that increases spending levels from the year before.
Well, not for the year that we are now in, for the current year. They're not going to increase so much. They would rather do an emergency appropriations bill like they did with Sandy. And remember, everybody didn't support that spending because there were people who said we want to find offsets for at least some of that, but that got overwhelmed at the time, and the concern about the need and so on. But I believe me, I'm not saying there's no hypocrisy in positions that people take. This is, after all, politics. But
Congressman Al.
And it's the politics that's preventing him from doing. What would have happened had they taken the proposal by the gentlewoman from New England that we were talking
about? Senator Kelly,
and brought it to a vote. Everybody knew they didn't have the votes, but brought it to a vote and see who voted for it and see who voted against it. And see if there aren't people out there that would like to make a lot of hay out of those people who voted against it. You've got to point fingers at people who aren't doing the job in a way that the public can see who is not helping the situation.
Alan Moore.
Well, with all respect, I think that if we'd had another alternative against the two that were out there, the two mainline ones, it would have just confused it further. There was a Democratic proposal. There was a Republican proposal. There was an opportunity for people to take a stand, take a vote. They did. And who among us knows who crossed party lines and voted for the other one? It's not like there was no potential accountability. It was just an exercise, though, where everybody knew neither one had the required votes. They went through the exercise. They had the votes, and then sequester followed.
Yeah, but Alan, when we do look at, you know, we saw it with Kennedy and Nixon. We saw it with Reagan and O'Neill, where, you know, look, you got a Republican, you've got a Democrat. You got a Republican offering and a Democrat offering. Why not at least sit down, dissect it, and find the best of both worlds? That seems to be an oblivious idea inside the halls of Congress.
Well, we disagree on that. I mean, it's a mess, but eventually we get there. But last week's vote on the sequester was not the time and place to do that when you just have a floor vote.
You may very well be right on that.
We've got breaking news out of Caracas, Venezuela. The Venezuelan government, according to CNN, has just announced that Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez has died in Caracas after a long respiratory illness aligned with chemotherapy and chemotherapy treatment for his cancer that he did in Cuba and in Venezuela. Again, CNN reporting, breaking news, Hugo Chavez has died. It is official. It has been confirmed by the Venezuelan government. We'll talk about that in the next hour. That's big news because that's going to change the global, or at least the hemispheric politics inside the Western Hemisphere. This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We'll be back in 4 minutes. Stay with us.
You know, here on Backroom Politics, you hear us order drinks during happy hour, the second hour of Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio. But what you don't understand is the quality of the drink that we're getting here at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Backroom Politics premier sponsor. Hey, you got Dave Hammerly and the bar crew there at Shelley's Back Room that really know how to pour a drink. Whether it's something simple like my on-air Jack Daniels on the rocks with a splash of water, or whether it's something elaborate like what has to be the best martini in the District of Columbia for Congressman Al Swift. Wine selection, scotch selection that will blow your mind. They've got Highland scotches. They've got Isle of Skye scotches, blended, single malt, anything you want. Port wines to go with that great cigar from the great humidor. Down here at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Come on down, have a drink, and make some new friends. Or heck, just come on down and listen to Backroom Politics on Tuesdays.
Time. tried one more once.
Back here live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We're going to be talking a little bit about breaking news coming out of Caracas, Venezuela. According to CNN, Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez has died after a long battle with respiratory failure and cancer. Again, the news out of CNN, Hugo Chavez has died. Joining us right now for our discussion on this is our international expert. He is the Vice President of China Affairs for the Eurasia Center, Dr. Ralph Winnie. And also joining us is Denise Krepp, former House Counsel for the Homeland Security Committee in the House of Representatives and former General Counsel of the U.S. Maritime Administration. Denise, welcome. Thanks for joining us on this. Kind of got sideways. We want to talk about cybersecurity, which we'll push off to the next segment, but we do want to talk about this breaking news. This is huge for hemispheric politics here in the Western Hemisphere. Denise, we'll start with you. Hugo Chavez has literally been a thorn in the side from a economic security standpoint. Venezuela, through its oil arm, PDVSA, has long been the largest producer of oil in the Western Hemisphere. They used to be the number one supplier of oil to the United States until Chavez took over. Does this change the security aspect of the hemisphere now that such a dynamic individual like Hugo Chavez has now passed away?
It's going to depend on what happens over the next couple of days.
If you were to take a guess, what are the possibilities of happening over the next couple of days? Does this give the opposition in Venezuela an opportunity to truly flex its muscles and take back serious political control of the government?
Absolutely. I mean, Hugo Chavez did a great job of quashing his opposition. I mean, he was doing his best to make sure that anybody and everybody who opposed him was put out of power. With his death comes the opportunity for those that opposed him to come in and to reemerge as possible contenders. Their opportunity and their capability of doing this will depend on who replaces Chavez and if his replacement has the power and the support of the military. That was his base.
Ralph Winnie, you know, we've heard of increased opposition rallies in Caracas, in the Venezuelan capital. When we look at the opposition in Venezuela, is it organized well enough? Is it strong enough to overthrow? I mean, no question about it, Hugo Chavez, long known for having his, for lack of a better term, junta available to him. Does this give the opposition, are they strong enough to take this opening?
I think so, but they're going to have to unite around one candidate in order to be able to fill the vacuum and take control in Venezuela. And the key is going to be how the U.S. and China react to this. China, of course, views Venezuela as a great opportunity to harness natural resources like oil and gas. And, of course, the United States has been very concerned about the Venezuela-Cuba connection. And now with the passing of Hugo Chavez, there's an opportunity for the U.S. to come in and to sever the ties between Venezuela and Cuba.
Alan Moore, this news has got to be somewhat of a relief to the folks down at the State Department and at the White House. Not that we wish ill on anybody. We don't praise the death of an individual. But this is a guy that has long been a serious, not so much threat, but a serious challenge here in the Western Hemisphere, particularly in organizations like the Organization of American States. Is this give the American government an opportunity to reengage the government in Caracas?
It might. We don't know. I mean, I think the first comment made is really the key one. The Vice President Maduro, who was the hand-picked successor of Chavez, we don't know much about. And if the military supports him, and if he chooses to do to follow the lead of Chavez. The question then is, does he have the charisma, the popular support that Chavez did? Probably not, but that doesn't mean that we suddenly can go in and separate them from Cuba, separate them from other actors in the Caribbean. We don't know yet. We don't know this guy Maduro. He's kind of been in charge behind the scenes because Chavez has spent most of the last few months in Cuba and out of sight. And on his return to Venezuela, he was in a military hospital, unavailable, invisible, and yet things continue to function. So I've got a more of a wait and see view of it. We don't know yet. There's clearly some change, but sometimes you have to be careful what you wish for, because it's, although I'm not predicting it, you know, sometimes you can do even worse than the devil known with the devil unknown.
But Bob Hines, when we look at, I mean, two major developments now in the past 7 days coming out of Latin America, one, the passing of President Hugo Chavez, the other is Raul Castro announcing that he will not seek re-election as president of the Cuban government. It almost seems like through nature and through politics, there's a political change in the winds happening, particularly in Latin America. Is that a good thing for the U.S.?
Well, let's look at it. Let's be square about it. You can't say there's a big change. All you can say is you don't know what the situation is. You don't know what will happen in Cuba. You don't know what's going to happen, as Alan just said, in Venezuela. The reality is, will the vice president, he's been basically running the country on a day-to-day basis for the last year and a half, approximately, I guess. So he's probably got pretty good hands on the reins already. Now, the question will become, does he have enough strength in himself, not the guy who was there because Chavez wanted him there to have his hands on the rein? Will he be strong enough to do it himself? And will the public see that Chavez what he inspired in them and way he acted? If the public doesn't want him, that might give us almost anything an opportunity, good, bad, or indifferent. In Cuba, I would presume, without knowing, that the system is going to continue, at least because of the long-term relationship. Castro has been there so long. I wouldn't want to take a guess at all of what might happen down there. Now, it's also true that that's a country that is so it's so close to the United States. There are amazingly numbers of ties between Cuba and the United States that are all informal, and it could be a huge change. And just to look at those two countries.
Well, more news coming out of Caracas right now. According to our friends at CNN, it was announced in a national broadcast by Vice President Nicolas Maduro at 4:25 Eastern Time. Apparently, Vice President Maduro, very emotional, teared up during the announcement. There's a strange dynamic as far as the role of Maduro, Denise Krepp, and exactly what was he doing as far as running the government. You had a Supreme Court down there that defied Hugo Chavez in saying he cannot be installed as a second-term president until he actually shows up in Caracas for his second swearing in, basically allowing Maduro to kind of be de facto leader of Venezuela right now. That's got to be a scary situation for the U.S. right now, as far as not having the unknowns. And, you know, again, not having a lot of information coming out of Caracas, but looking forward, assuming that there's going to be a possible Maduro presidency as a result of this, a lot of things are still in flux as a result of Chavez not being sworn in.
It's going to be in flux, but Chavez was a charismatic leader, and he's been in power now for about 13-plus years. So you have an entire generation of folks who know nothing more than Chavez. And there's going to be a tendency for many of them to say, okay, my allegiance was with Chavez, and because I trusted in him so much, I will transfer my allegiance to the man or woman he picked to defeat him. So there's going to be part of that, and that may hold part of it. But the ability for his replacement to hold on to the power that Chavez gave him is really going to depend on the military and the folks that back Chavez. Chavez spent a lot of money throughout the government. He spent a lot of money on the everyday person. If that everyday person remembers that money, that everyday person is going to want to support the person that Chavez replaces. But that being said, Chavez is gone. Will the person who replaced Chavez spend the money in the same manner that Chavez spent that money? Will he or she give the money to the people?
Ralph Winning.
Yeah, I agree with Denise. I think that's a very valid point. I also think it's going to be interesting to see how Iran plays this angle, because Ahmadinejad have very close ties with Chavez, and I'm sure he's going to have to try and maintain very strong ties with Maduro.
Does this, in fact, throw a little bit of a wrench in OPEC? Obviously, Venezuela, a member of OPEC, the only one in the Western Hemisphere that's a member of OPEC. Is this going to hamper their ability for production, for distribution, and, you know, is the price of oil going to be affected on this?
Well, I think it remains to be seen exactly how the Venezuela-Iranian relationship will develop under Maduro. Certainly, Ahmadinejad wants to keep Venezuela as a strong ally. The key will be what can Iran offer this new government.
Interesting point. Well, we're going to keep an eye on this as we move forward. Again, breaking news out of Caracas, President Hugo Chavez, 58 years old, has passed away after a battle with respiratory illness in Caracas, Venezuela. The news was announced by Vice President Maduro within the past hour. We'll keep an eye on that. We'll report any other breaking news coming out of that. Let's go back to the topic that we were going to discuss here in the segment, and it'll bleed over to the next segment. Big politics surrounding news coming out of China regarding cybersecurity. There is a definite threat. DHS and DOD are both ramping up efforts to increase our cybersecurity efforts, but it seems like our biggest threat in cybersecurity is the Chinese. Denise Krepp, I want to go to you. Cybersecurity has always been on the burner of national security, but it just seems it's kind of exploded over the past 2 years. Why is it now taking prevalence?
It's taking prevalence because you had a report that came out that said that the Chinese military was hacking.
Is that something that, you're referring to a report that was released last week saying that all the cyber hacking has been originated at a building owned by the People's Liberation Army in China, and it's military officials that are doing the hacking, not 12-year-olds eating Hot Pockets in their mom's basement.
Right, and I guess for me, I had to chuckle when the report came out because people are so focused on the Chinese that I'm thinking, wake up, folks, there's another problem. And you mind if I go in?
No, what is the other problem?
MorphoTrust.
Talk a little bit about MorphoTrust.
MorphoTrust is a foreign-owned company with a U.S. subsidiary. The U.S. subsidiary has been given contracts by 41 out of 50 states, plus the District of Columbia, to work on all the licenses. All your driver's licenses are being produced, and the databases associated with that are produced by a U.S. subsidiary of a foreign company. In addition, MorphoTrust has been given a $248 million contract by the Department of Homeland Security to manage the biometrics for 2 million transportation workers. Yep.
That's the transportation worker identity card.
That is the card. Lockheed Martin had that contract. Now MorphoTrust has that contract. So if MorphoTrust has the information for 41 out of 50 states plus the District of Columbia, has the information for 2 million transportation workers, and now we're hearing we're going to have biometric social security cards plus background checks and biometrics for gun owners, who do you think is going to have this contract? It's going to be a U.S. subsidiary of a foreign-owned company.
Now, obviously, that brings up a huge point. That is a database owned by a foreign national corporation with a U.S. proxy board subsidiary.
Yeah.
But it also brings up that we don't know how tight their cybersecurity infrastructure is. We don't know, is it a threat from, let's say, the Chinese? Is it in fact a threat, or is this a red herring?
Absolutely, it's a threat. All of a sudden, we're going to be consolidating all of the biometric and identifications for every person in the United States into one giant database. And you can't tell me that database can't be hacked by the Chinese. The Chinese have successfully hacked into the Department of Defense. They're going to be able to hack into the nice database that Morpho Trust holds.
Bob Hines.
I have a question. Couldn't, no matter who owned this company, couldn't they be hacked?
Yes.
So is it, I mean, I'm trying to understand why it's more dangerous to have a foreign country own it. Personally, I think it is. But I'm trying to understand factually and not just emotionally, why is it more dangerous to have a company outside involved here?
Well, first of all, if you're going to create this type of a database, I'd love to have seen it be built by a U.S.-owned company.
Yeah.
Because I love to hear about U.S. jobs. So it would have been nice to have a U.S. company. Now you're talking to me about a foreign-owned company. It's a foreign-owned company that wants to make a profit. I fully understand that. I fully support business. So you've got a U.S. subsidiary who's responding to a foreign-owned company who needs to make money off of U.S. identification information.
And why would the United States government ever make that kind of a deal?
I don't know.
No, but
Alan Moore. Sure. Alan Moore, go ahead.
It's not like I don't know anything about this. Okay,
I've never
heard of Morpho Trust, but I'm not prepared to condemn decisions that 40 some states made and that Homeland Security made before I know more about it. It's a U.S. subsidiary. My guess is there are a bunch of firewalls. If Homeland Security is involved, you would sure as hell hope that they know exactly what's going on in terms of firewalls and protections. And I don't know anything about any of it, but I'm not going
to condemn in the absence of more information. Well, I'm not condemning it. I'm asking, I'd like to know what the rationale was, because I don't see a rationale here except that it was probably the cheapest bid.
Probably. Well, it
was probably the best bid, and the best is not always the cheapest, you know. And we don't know, so
yes.
I think we just have to be careful before we
agree.
Before we draw conclusions.
Absolutely agree. But it does raise serious questions. I mean, going back to the overarching issue of cybersecurity, you know, when you look at cybersecurity and you look at the recent events happening around hackings of the New York Times, hackings of DOD. It has caused a strain between Washington and Beijing. Ralph Whitney, are we looking at the new Cold War as a result of what we're seeing coming out of these reports?
I think potentially we are, and that's why John Frisbee, who's the chairman of the U.S.-China Business Council, has been very vocal in saying the governments of U.S. and China, they have to sit down and work out this problem, because it's going to prevent constructive trade relations between the two countries. The big problem with cybersecurity is that companies are unwilling to admit that they've been hacked, because they're afraid of how their shareholders or their customers are going to react. They don't want to have lawsuits, and they're very afraid of unwanted government intrusion. And that makes it even more difficult to be able to respond and to be able to help people down the line or other companies that get hacked.
But, you know, Alan Moore, when we talk about this issue, one, nobody wants their identity out there for public viewing. But when you look at a foreign national government that is allegedly involved in the infiltration of these databases where your personal data is held, there's got to be something there that's got to be a wake-up call to the American public that says, hey, this is a problem. We've got to fix this.
I got to say that this is really, really hard for me, because I'm just shocked that the Chinese are trying to break into the Defense Department. The next thing you're going to tell me is the U.S. government is doing that kind of thing with other countries and other places. Please don't tell me that, because that would just really, really just totally wreck my day.
Allow me to give you a piece of counsel. I'll make you a bet we are.
Well, I mean, but in respect to that, Bob,
you're not going to get a bottle of wine on that.
I sold Bob his bottle of wine. Hey, but when you look at it though, Bob, back to your point though, you know, there are reports coming out of Washington and out of other international organizations. They're saying, look, we're being hypocritical. You can't say that the Chinese are the evil empire by doing this when you yourselves are doing it. There are still people that are convinced that we did it to an Iranian nuclear reactor operational system in Iran. So is this the new front of a global war that we're just now starting to see the tip of the iceberg on, Bob?
Well, I think it is. I think that's exactly what it is. I suspect we're doing it. I suspect the Chinese are doing it. I wouldn't, you know, my view of this discussion.
I suspect Molly is doing
it. Israel.
Everybody does.
Yeah, but, you know, Mike, my only earlier question is, why would we make it maybe easier for the Chinese to do it, because it's a foreign company and we don't have nearly as much control as one otherwise has. But the fact of the matter is, I think that we're doing it. I think Iran's doing it. I think the Saudis are. I think everybody who knows how to do it is doing it.
Now, in fairness,
like kind of like sex that way.
In fairness
to this company, and I want to go back to what Alan Moore was saying, is this is a company that responded to a request for proposals from these agencies. They provided the bids. They provided their management approach, how their security approach is going to be done, and they won fairly and squarely. This is not an indictment on any particular company, but Bob, to your point, it does raise a couple of questions. And again, we're talking about a company that is regulated by CFIUS. CFIUS obviously had to approve this deal, but is it the logical method to go? Do we want companies' proxy boards or not? A lot of Canadian companies are doing this, and we don't have a problem with that, Bob.
No, I don't think we do. But see, maybe we should. I mean, I would suspect there are no. I suspect the Chinese government is not having American contractors doing cyber stuff for them.
We're not also accusing this company of having Chinese contractors doing any of this work either.
I'm just curious.
Ralph Winnie.
Right. If you ask the Chinese, they're adamant in the fact that their military is not involved in cybersecurity, and that they have laws and regulations that make hacking illegal. And yes, they do go after their own people domestically within China, but they're unable to control it when it becomes an international issue. And the only way you're going to control cybersecurity is to show the Chinese it's going to cost them money. You have companies like Boeing and Caterpillar, financial services companies like JP Morgan Chase, all of which are part of the U.S.-China business coalition, say, look, we have to pull out because we're concerned about hacking. It would send a message to the Chinese and to other countries where these companies are based.
Are these companies willing to do that in one of the largest emerging markets in the world?
With the exception of Google, no. And that's the whole problem. These companies have to come forward and say, look, we're being hacked, and we can't operate in your system anymore. If you look at patent and trademark infringements, when Michael Jordan went over to China, he marketed Air Jordan. All of a sudden, this Chinese company started putting together similar shoes, a similar patent and brand as to Air Jordan. Well, what did Michael Jordan do? He hired a Chinese lawyer. He filed a suit in Chinese court. He went on a media campaign. And this was all broadcast through China Daily. It was on all the major outlets in China. And all of a sudden, the Chinese government decided they needed new laws for patent and trademark infringement, all because of one person, Michael Jordan, who is revered by the Chinese public. So you're going to need someone to really come out and basically talk about hacking, talk about how it's affecting their company, and it has to be someone that the Chinese respect and admire.
Denise Krebs, you had a comment.
I do. I mean, there's a difference between business-sensitive information, and that I'm going to leave up to the Walmart and the Targets of the world. They're going to be very concerned about that. I'm concerned about privacy data, and I'm concerned about my information, my own personal information. So my question is, why aren't we all talking about this more? Why aren't we, as an individual, as a nation, saying, how much of my information is on the computer? Who controls my information? I mean, in addition to talking about, you know, the biometrics that I said about the transportation workers, all of a sudden, underneath the Obama healthcare requirement, there's a new requirement that says all of the healthcare data has to be computerized. Okay, so who's protecting that type of data? I mean, if we are moving towards more data on computer systems, who is protecting this information, and how are we ensuring that somebody can't hack into it and consolidate it? I mean, soon you're going to have somebody say, okay, I'm going to Google your name, or I'm going to do whatever I need to do to the system, and then I'm going to find out everything about you. I mean, that's my concern. We need to be having a conversation as a nation of how are we protecting this information, who has access to it, and how do they control it?
But Denise, this goes to a larger issue of when we talk about cybersecurity, when we talk about the new electronic realm of privacy data, where's the balance between corporations providing a service to the government that the government does not inherently have, doing it through the proper procurement processes in alliance with the federal acquisition regulations. At the same time, the need for new and tougher laws, more stringent laws regarding cybersecurity, at the same time, in a fiscal crisis, having to invest in improving our cybersecurity infrastructure. Where's that balance and where do we fill the gaps?
Well, first of all, I'm glad you brought up the cost. My father's a family practice doctor in North Carolina, and every time I go home, he tells me about how much money he is spending to computerize his system. The cost that's being borne when you start talking about everything that's moving on to the system is being borne by small business owners. It's not being borne by, you know, individuals. It's being borne by small business folks. So that's where the cost is being, you know, who's paying for the cost. We as individuals aren't necessarily paying the cost right now because we're not paying to have our information put on the data. Well, the cost we're going to have is if somebody hacks into the system and screws around with our bank accounts, screws around with our health care, screws around with our benefits as it relates to Social Security. So, I mean, that's where I'm concerned about it.
Has America been lax, Denise, in the way that we've dealt with cybersecurity? Have we been a little naive in all this?
Okay, let me go back to the comment you said. Am I completely and utterly surprised that the Chinese have hacked into it? Absolutely not. But is this the conversation that people are having at their dinner tables? No, and I think it should be.
But Alan Moore, when we look at the balance between privacy of personal information versus coming into a new electronic age, there is a tight, tight line that we're walking on this. You know, at what point do we say enough's enough, paper's not so bad?
I don't think we ever can go back to that. I think the challenge is, as was said, is making sure in a rapidly changing environment that there are firewalls, that there are protections, and it's a duty that falls on government. It's a duty that falls on corporations, as us as individuals around the table, and so on. I totally agree with that, and it's way beyond, you know, my knowledge and my ability. I do have a problem with some of the sense around the table that there's a problem that a foreign company with a U.S.-owned subsidiary has these contracts as though because there's some foreigners somehow involved, so far unidentified, that's bad, whereas American companies would be good. And I'm thinking, oh, yeah, let's see. Maybe Enron. Oh, darn, they're out of business. Lehman Brothers, could they? Oops, nope, sorry. Countrywide. Oh, no, they're gone. Citicorp, some of the companies that had to be bailed out. Maybe Bernie Madoff. Oh, shoot, he's not able to invest anymore. You know, it's not as though just because it's American, it's good. And if there's some kind of foreign parent, it's bad. One would hope that as the decisions are being made, that they're looking at quality as well as cost as well as security, and we get what we want. It doesn't bother me that there's a German parent or a Singapore parent. I don't know who the parent company is. It doesn't particularly matter. I just would I would totally agree, though, that there's a duty on those providing the contracts, and if Homeland Security isn't doing it, wow. But that we protect the data and we stay up to date, because people are trying to hack in, not just the Chinese. Everybody's trying to hack in and know what everybody else is doing. That's the world we live in now. I don't see us going back to paper.
Well, we're going to let that be the last word on this. This is obviously an issue that's going to continue to rear its ugly head. There's still information that's popping as a result of a lot of these reports regarding China, and a lot of these CFIUS issues that are coming up as well. Want to thank Denise Krupp for joining us today. Thank you very much, Denise. Great talk. When we come back, we're going to change pace a little bit. Other breaking news coming out of Seoul and Pyongyang. Apparently, the North Korean government has said that they are going to disband the truce that has been in effect since the late 50s, and they are literally staring down the gun of a new war in the Korean Peninsula. We'll talk about that when we come back. This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Stay with us. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
You know, you hear us talk about Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. It's being the place to be. America's premier cigar tavern, place to make new friends or visit old friends, or even have a lively political discussion like we do here on Backroom Politics. But what you may not know, Shelley's is the place for private parties. Shelley's Backroom is available to host events for groups of 10 to 250. From cocktail receptions to sit-down dinners, Shelley's can provide custom menu options to suit your needs and budget. Although Shelley's is a smoke-friendly environment, Shelley's can make accommodations for non-smokers based on the size of your party, but heck, why would you want to? With a cigar menu like they have here, why would you even consider going smoke-free? Event pricing varies based on the time of the day of the week chosen for your event. For more information on private parties at Shelley's Backroom, go to www.shelleysbackroom.com/private-party. Shelley's Backroom, the place to be, as Bob likes to say it. It's also the place for private parties.
Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics on Blog Talk Radio. Change of pace right now. Again, want to report the breaking news coming out of Caracas, Venezuela. For those of you who did not join us for the last segment, Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez has died. 58-year-old President of Venezuela succumbed to his respiratory failure. And now a lot of questions coming out of Venezuela. More details as they become available. We're going to change pace a little bit. We're going to stay in the Pacific Rim and talk a little bit about the new flexing of the muscles by President Kim Jong-un and the North Koreans. It was announced today out of Pyongyang, according to several news sources in South Korea, that the North Koreans have, in fact, cut all communications to South Korea on the DMZ. They have taken away and cut off the bat phone, as they call it, allowing for the military leaders to talk to one another. And Pyongyang is threatening a new military offensive to, quote, reunite the Korean Peninsula. We're going to go back to our international expert, Ralph Winnie. Ralph, we've seen them flex muscles. We've seen them do nuclear tests on the day of the State of the Union. We saw them launch what can be amounted to a glorified, Roman candle into the air, which now they claim they have ballistic missile capability and rocket capability. But when you talk about cutting off communications with Seoul, is this the beginning of a new offensive by Pyongyang? And are they serious about pulling the trigger on a new offensive into South Korea, regardless of international concern?
I think they are trying to flex their muscles, and they want to send a message that they're very upset at these new sanctions, which for the first time the Chinese are really backing to the hilt. China has traditionally backed sanctions against North Korea, but they've watered down very tough sanctions. These new ones are at the heart of the regime's preventing them from moving money around the world. They're preventing them from getting luxury items like yachts and racing cars.
Because there's a huge luxury yacht market in North Korea.
Well, the people at the top love all these luxury goods, while everyone else is starving.
So basically, Kim Jong-il can't get his Bentley, and that pisses him off. Therefore,
right.
We should raise more on the Korean Peninsula. Brilliant.
It's not rational. It really isn't. And the Chinese have been very displeased since the February 12th nuclear test.
Alan Moore.
So this is a weird one, even for the North Koreans. And
are you going to bring up the basketball player?
Yeah,
you're
trying to figure out, okay, what changed here? What occurred? Well, Dennis Rodman, he of the multiple body tattoos
and
face piercings.
This is a guy who couldn't get his face through a metal detector.
He made a visit to North Korea. He hung out with President Kim. And the first American to do so came away saying, he's my friend, he's awesome. And then he was trying to explain it over the weekend, what he meant. And Rodman, was starting to take a lot of flack, including from the White House. So my theory is, President Kim decided, hey, Dennis is our friend, we need a diversionary tactic, so let's threaten to invade South Korea. It's just too strange, everything that goes on there. Now, you can't just totally dismiss it as nothing, but it's hard to believe that there's very much here.
But, Bob Hines, I mean, you are talking about an unstable, isolated country. I mean, we still don't know the real situation in North Korea because they are so isolated, so internalized. But when you start looking at millions of rabid North Koreans going to the DMZ and beginning a new strategic war against their South counterparts, that creates a whole new level of instability in the Asian Pacific Rim.
Well, I think, yes, it does. But my view is, and I think I know what Ralph would say, but it strikes me that if there's anybody who wants to keep the North Koreans from doing something crazy, which will require a rather strong response, maybe by us dropping something big on them, let's face it, that's the last thing the Chinese want.
Right, absolutely.
I mean, this new tact coming out of Pyongyang has got to scare the bejesus out of Beijing, Ralph.
They ought to piss them off.
Yeah, they're very, very angry. I think they feel very, very betrayed by the North Korean government, who they have been trying to move along towards the path of what they consider capitalism. Because and let's not forget, we think China is bad now. Look at how they were back in the 60s and 70s. I mean, there was very much like the situation in North Korea. And the Chinese have always viewed their role as trying to educate and inform the North Koreans. And look, you can stay in power, but follow our mode of capitalism. Yet the North Koreans are actively resisting that. And there's elements within the North Korean military that are hardcore Marxist-Leninists that feel that the Chinese have sort of betrayed the cause and moved towards more of a capitalist mode. And that makes it difficult for the Chinese to be able to control them.
But Congressman Al, I mean, the reality is, there's a noticeable strong infrastructure in the North Korean military. A lot of their money goes into that. The idea of having the North Koreans start up a new offensive against the South Koreans is not exactly something that this administration wants to deal with as a front line in foreign policy. Secretary Kerry's got his fill of things he's going to have to deal with, whether it's Iran and a nuclear North Korea. Where does America literally come down and say, look, we've got to start new bilateral negotiations
with the North Koreans?
Well, is yesterday...
Yesterday would be a good idea.
But on the other hand, it takes two... I mean, there's some interesting parallels between this and what's going on in Congress. You know, you got to talk to each other. You've got, you know... So I think the United States has got a very difficult situation here, because if, in fact, the North Koreans were to invade, and they are militarily powerful, I don't know the military strength of the South Koreans. I don't know what Japan would be willing to do, given that they're very nervous about their own military, having a military. It seems to me we would have to move in. That moves us into another war, as though we don't have enough going on already. So maybe it's wishful thinking, but it's very comforting to think that the North Koreans are just making a feint, and seeing what reaction there is, and that they're not going to do it, and that the Chinese will come in and help us, or help the situation.
Bob Hines, we were talking before the show, you and I were talking earlier here at Shelley's, about the fact that you're dealing with a government that thought that Dennis Rodman would be a great envoy between the two countries. This guy's an ass clown, for lack of a better term. And for the reality of this, you've got the North Koreans talking about major offensive in the South Korea. At the same time, they're bringing Dennis Rodman in as the envoy back to the United States. Are they naive? Are they isolated? Do they just not know the reality of the global world outside of North Korea?
Yes, everything you said, yes.
I was talking to Bob Hines, but thank you.
I know you were.
Appreciate it.
But the answer was rather obvious.
I have no idea what they thought they would gain from having Dennis Rodman come over there. But the fact of the matter is, they're playing a dangerous game. And I believe that no matter how lunatic they may be or sensible, I don't know where they are on a scale of 1 to 10, but I do know one thing, I believe, and that is the last thing the Chinese want is to have a war on the Korean Peninsula right next door to them.
Yeah.
So I cannot believe that the Chinese will not do everything they have to do to see to it that they invite any Looney Tune they want to come over and talk to their leadership, but they don't do anything else.
But Ralph Winnie, how much influence is Beijing willing to put in on calming North Korea down from this new offensive?
As the situation gets worse, the Chinese recognize that instability in that region.
How much worse can it get? They're talking about invading South Korea.
Right. I mean, right now it's all talk, but it's going to come dangerously close. I think the one good thing about this resolution is that it leaves the door open to a renewal of the stalled six-party aid for disarmament talks between the Koreas, U.S., China, Russia, and Japan. And that's something that the Chinese and Russians really feel was very important to signing on to this resolution.
Does the American government take a more proactive approach to North Korea in this, or is it in our best interest to, in fact, be a little defensive on this, hoping that we're going to play this global game of chicken, somebody will back down?
Well, I'm not sure where the chicken part comes in. I mean, what we've seen from North Korea now for years is increasingly provocative actions and words. And what we don't want to do is reward provocation. And I'm guessing we'll be very cautious. We'll say these kinds of comments are not helpful. They're not helpful in the region. They're not helpful for North Korea. They're not helpful for North Korea's visibility and respect around the world. And we hope that they will tame the rhetoric and reengage in conversation. But I don't see us doing anything particularly assertive or aggressive.
Congressman Al,
I'd like to ask Ralph a question.
Okay.
How close does the United States work with China on the North Korean issue? And would it benefit us to, if we're not close on that, to, instead of us reacting to North Korea, go to China and say, what can we do to help you deal with this situation?
Yeah, and I think we're moving in that direction, especially with these sanctions that are likely to be approved at the Thursday general session meeting. As I said before, China has supported sanctions, but they've always been watered down because the Chinese have been afraid that it would lead to a refugee problem, where you have a flood of North Korean refugees coming into China. But because the Chinese were so angry at the February 12th tests by the North Koreans, they have really come on board in supporting these tough sanctions. You know, they want to punish North Korea for this illicit activity. At the same time, they want it to be proportionate to the crime, in effect.
So we have an option of working effective. I mean, with some energy through China rather than us directly getting involved.
Yeah, I think we do, especially now with John Kerry. I think we have an opportunity to work directly with China to bring North Korea under control.
How effective is John Kerry going to be dealing with the Chinese on the North Korean question?
I think it remains to be seen, but I think he's following in the lines of Hillary Clinton and will work very hard to maintain a very close relationship with the Chinese to bring the North Korean situation into focus. Now, if this, if the opportunity to provide food aid in for disarmament, if that issue is going to be pushed, that'll be the key. Because, as I said, the draft resolution leaves that option open. And maybe that's what the North Koreans are pushing for. They want food aid. And they think if they scream and yell and threaten loud enough, that'll create an opportunity for that to be restored.
Well, very good. Well, we've got about 12 minutes left in the program, and we're going to bring up my favorite part of the show. It's Tell Me a Story, where we talk about the latest rumor, innuendo, buzz, going around the Beltway, anything and everything's in play. Congressman Al, I know you love this segment, so I'm going to skip you, and I'll go back to you later. Bob Hines, Tell Me a Story.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Bob Hines, Tell Me a Story.
We were talking earlier in the early hour about the fiscal situation with our government faces. I won't repeat any of it at all, just to say this. I think that the continuing resolution, which must be adopted by the 27th of March, will be so after, you know, the Senate's going to do one kind of a resolution that approves the dollars and does a few things they want to do. The House is going to do the same thing. They'll work things out. I have no doubt at all that they will not have a problem getting a continuing resolution adopted at the final hours. They will get it done, and we will be able to finance the government through September.
Alan Moore, Tell Me a Story.
White House Press Secretary Jay Carney had a very, very bad week. Let's review. He was set out day after day to talk about the catastrophe that sequestration was going to create, and including a session where they brought out Secretary of Education Arne Duncan to describe the problem, who made the claim that turned out to be embarrassingly false, that teachers were already being laid off up in West Virginia, something that earned him 4 Pinocchios from the fact checker at the Washington Post. That's the worst you can do, by the way. And Carney, when asked about it, just refused to kind of acknowledge that mistakes had been made from the podium. He then got himself into, the polite term, I think, is a pissing match with George Will and Bob Woodward, two guys who work for an organization that buys ink by the barrel, and seemed to think that somehow that was going to work out for him. But I think his absolute low point came when he was challenged about this political organization that the president's campaign people have put together to try to generate support for the president's initiatives, and have set out to big donors, you pay $500,000 and you will get to be on an advisory committee that meets quarterly with the press event. And he was asked, gee, are you selling access for $500,000 to the president? And he said, no, There is no set price for access to the president.
Oops. Oops. He had such a bad week. Can he
recover?
Can he recover? Is he losing his edge? And might we see a new press secretary in the near future?
Bob Hines.
Would we want him to recover as Republicans? At least me. I love him there.
Well, I want to bring up, Alan, something in your story. You talked about Bob Woodward. I mean, over the weekend, it was announced that Bob Woodward had personally been threatened by the White House. And various emails coming from various White House officials, Bob Woodward was told that he will, quote-unquote, regret calling out the president on the false overhype of sequestration. Is Bob Woodward, one, wrong about the fact that he was threatened? And B, this is not the first time that a White House has said you'll regret saying something. Go back a la Nixon and Woodward Bernstein.
This is a strange one. These two guys obviously know each other. Gene Sperling, the president's chief economic advisor, and Woodward.
Bob.
They've known each other a long time. They apparently had a very heated yelling argument earlier in the day, prompting Sperling to say, "Hey, as your friend, you've got this wrong, and I think you're going to regret it." And then Woodward, for reasons that are not clear, allowed this to play out as a threat to him. It didn't look that way. It didn't read that way. But what's missing is what occurred in their phone conversation. Why was Sperling so angry? What was going on? And it wouldn't surprise me if he said, "You know, you're going to regret this. We're going to trash you. We're not going to give you access because you're just wrong." That part doesn't. You know, it just seems strange. It's sort of an inside the Beltway kind of story. The White House then began to gang up. David Plouffe put out some ugly stuff that he's old and losing it. It's not helpful to the White House to get into those kinds of fights, which doesn't mean that Woodward necessarily was right. I think he misplayed it.
Has the White House lost control of its media machine, Alan?
It hasn't lost control, but maybe it's interesting. Because David Axelrod and David Plouffe are no longer focused on an election and probably have a little more ability to tweet whatever they want, they can become a new source of problems in what has always been a very tightly controlled enterprise.
Very interesting. Rob Pointy, tell me a story.
Okay. There's some smooth operators out of Jamaica and Nigeria that have been contacting Americans over the age of 65, telling them that they have won, that they are the grand prize winner. And these people are being asked to give their bank account information. Well, thousands of Americans have done this and have lost all their money in their accounts. Look for hearings on the Hill to get to the bottom of who's behind this.
I thought that guy was for real.
This is old news.
No,
and I have another one. Second one.
Well, no, we only
allow
one.
You've given Alan two. So.
All right.
Where we've been talking about North Korea, and their refusal now, they're pushing not to honor the armistice that was signed in the mid-50s. Look for the North Koreans to push for a more formal peace treaty between the U.S. and North Korea. They would like the U.S. to recognize North Korea as a sovereign member of the international community.
Interesting. Al Swift has a story. Tell me a story.
All winter long, we have had predictions of snow. All winter long, we have had no snow. My prediction is there will be no snow tomorrow.
Oh, very good. So,
would you come over to my shovel my yard if it get it?
No, of course not. So,
I won't be able to get there.
The story regarding Senator Bob Menendez, the junior senator or the senior senator out of New Jersey, continues to get weirder and weirder. Just when you thought it couldn't get any messier, the escort accuser of Senator Bob Menendez, in the past 24 hours, has recanted her story, which makes for an interesting dynamic of, wait a minute, the FBI is still investigating Senator Menendez for strange actions that's happened regarding a jet trip down to the Dominican Republic. This could be the final swan song of Senator Bob Menendez. Alan Moore, you wanted to add to that.
The woman who recanted, supposedly, as the Washington Post reported, is, according to Daily Caller, the website that put this that produced this story in the first place, Daily Caller said, she's not the one we talked to. She can't recant. She's not our source. So it lives on. Menendez continues to be burdened by too many problems here, and I agree with your conclusion.
There's a lot of unanswered questions regarding a lot of things surrounding Bob Menendez. The senator has got an issue, and he doesn't seem to know how to get out of his own way. It's going to be an interesting play over the next couple of weeks. I would venture to say Cory Booker will probably be in the Senate a lot quicker than he may have anticipated. With that, on behalf of Congressman Al Swift, Bob Hines, Alan Moore, our international expert, Ralph Winnie, special thanks to our special guest, Denise Krepp from the House Homeland Security Committee and the U.S. Maritime Administration. This has been Backroom Politics. We will be here live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Bob?
The place to be.
Absolutely. Woo! We'll be here next week. Hey, I hope you survive Snowmageddon or Snowquestration. Have a good one, Washington. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Woo! Thank you.